You're listening to Radio Berkman from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You can find show notes for this episode and more programs like this at blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman.
Do you hear the news? I'm going to make records.
No kidding!
The established music industry has been in a bit of a decline. That should be no surprise to any regular listeners to this show. After all, we all know that CD sales have plummeted, digital music sales have failed to make up the difference, and record labels have cut around 25% of their staff. But a new economy for music has begun to arise. This isn't an economy solely made of dollars and cents. Rather, it's an economy mediated by a currency of social exchange. You see, when artists engage with fans on new media, it's more difficult to put a monetary value on the interaction. That isn't to say that record labels haven't tried. By some accounting, a Facebook friend might average out to $1.63 per year in sales, whereas a mailing list member is $2.50. But engagement can come in a million different forms anymore, and how an artist engages is a lot more instinctual and human, and less based on the likelihood of a profit. Today's guest, Nancy Boehm, teaches communications at the University of Kansas. She recently released the book Personal Connections in the Digital Age, a research-rich book about the effects of the net as a mediator of human relationships. She also writes about how fans of music, film, and television continue to experience and interact around their favorite creators on the net, and the strong ties that result.
I would describe my primary area of investigation as trying to understand how the internet is leading to reshaping the relationships between audiences and creative producers. So one of the changes that the internet has really brought is a shift from these very impersonal kinds of ways that creators and audiences have connected to a much more personal relationship element in there. So I would say that I'm trying to understand how relationships are being reshaped and what the consequences of those are.
And you're looking pretty specifically as in one example of the music industry right here.
Yeah, yeah. My first book was about soap opera fans and about fan communication in that context. So I have worked in the area of television, but that was in the early, mid-90s that I was doing that work, and it was really before producers had caught on to the idea that fans were participatory, and it was really, you could sort of see that there was an emerging power struggle that was going to happen between what audiences were doing online and what industry actors were used to doing. But now I'm looking at music just because I think a lot of things are happening in music that will fan out to other areas over time. I think music is sort of at the cutting edge of a lot of these issues. Plus, I'm a huge music fan, so.
Right, I was going to ask you about that because have expressed interest in a lot of diverse groups and singer-songwriters, and you know, you seem to be one of those people who is like kind of on the cutting edge, or what you know, my less diplomatic friends would call a music snob. And I was wondering how you got interested in this subject and like researching this area.
I try not to be snobby about it. You know, I mean, just to speak to that for a second, and then I'll answer your question. I think music taste is so incredibly personal that I just don't judge. I have no explanation for why one song moves me and another leaves me cold. And I don't think maybe Daniel Levitin has an explanation for it, but he's probably the only one. He wrote that This Is Your Brain on Music book. I think there's no explaining it why music works. This works for some people and that works for some people. So I don't judge other people for their taste, and I hope I don't get judged for mine. But how I got interested in this, it's actually a sort of serendipitous tale, and I don't know if it's a model for how people ought to think about going about their research. I'm thinking here of students and people who are becoming researchers, but I was asked to present about community at a symposium on online community, and I really wanted to go, but I hadn't been doing any work on online community, and at the time I was co-editing a book about qualitative research methods in the internet. It's called Internet Inquiry, came out last year. So I thought, well, I could take sort of some of the things that we've been doing in this book and talk about them in terms of online community. So one of the issues was, how do you bound the object of your study? And so I wanted to make the argument that it's really hard to bound an online community, that when I studied Usenet, it was really easy. You went to RecArts TV Soaps, and that was your community. And that now community is so distributed that it's very hard to know where do I stop, where does the community begin and end, is it even really a community? So as I was putting that talk together, I needed an example to demonstrate it. And because I was a big fan of Swedish pop and had been sort of actively investigating this community because I had sort of just discovered it and I was finding all this music that I was really excited about, and I was finding that there was sort of a community built around it, I used that as the example for this talk that I gave. And people who saw that talk said, oh, this is such important work. You really need to publish this. And I said, oh, well, twist my arm. If I have to write about Swedish indie pop, I'll do it. You know. So.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, music is definitely one of the more personal tastes that a person can have. And it also, through understanding what we like about music, we can understand ourselves better. And a lot of spaces online have taken advantage of that concept. If you see, Pandora, which will take one artist that you know you're interested in and then show you a panoply of, mm-hmm. of other artists that all of a sudden you're, you know, serendipitously in love with. And I'm actually thinking about an example I saw yesterday of a dating site that's based on Last FM.
Yeah, I actually did a study on Last FM about friendship on Last FM, and I looked at
Last FM is a similar service to Pandora, where people can stumble upon music.
Yeah, it gives you recommendations. The big difference in that between Last FM and Pandora is that whereas Pandora actually has a cast of characters who sit there with headphones and code music based on pre-identified criteria, Last FM bases it solely on what people listen to. So it's all people who listen to this also listen to that, and it doesn't pay any attention to the content of the sound like Pandora does. The other big difference is that Last FM allows people, it has the whole social connection element, so you can friend each other. And so I did a study that was a survey that Last FM helped me with in terms of getting access to people. When you load a Last FM page, it brings up your friends in a random order, just like Facebook does. So I had people pick the friend who was at the top of their list at that moment, and I had a long survey about that friendship. And I was looking at one of the things I was looking at is, does shared taste in music predict how developed the relationship is? So are people, we have that whole, you know, music is a window to the soul, and if we share musical taste, then we're soul sisters and we're going to be close. And the answer was no, they had nothing to do with each other. The people who knew each other face to face also to begin with and who shared taste in music were really close, but people who met on the site and shared taste in music never got close, which isn't to say that the relationship wasn't valuable. Because I think they did achieve a lot of benefits from that relationship in the form of music recommendations or people to talk to about music and those kinds of things. I would have thought, you know, that people who met on site and shared musical tastes would have developed, become closer than people who met on site and didn't, but no.
They would have found some sort of mystical bonds in common.
Not.
But it turns out that it's more like a racquetball partner like, or that you find at the gym.
Yeah, yeah. It just didn't. Musical taste had no correlation with relational development at all. And I mean, part of that is also because people who friend each other on those sites, we're good friends. And so we're friends on that site as well. And we're friends for all kinds of reasons. And it's not just music. So the idea that just sharing music is enough to form a close connection, it's not.
Well, there's been similar experiments with Mac. I believe there's like a
yeah, right.
Cupertino
there's the,
or,
right,
no,
the,
or,
right,
what is,
right.
I don't know,
Cupertino, right, for Mac users. And, I mean, you know, what makes a relationship work or fail is based on many more things than a single criterion. Right. If you share taste in music, but one of you belches and the other one can't stand that, it's not going to happen. Right?
And good luck to that person in finding the person out there who loves your belches.
An
endearing quality.
Hey, I belch too. We can belch together
exactly.
In harmony.
You're listening to Radio Berkman. Today we're speaking with Nancy Baim, who researches how musicians and music fans engage on the web. Fan engagement on the web often bypasses the cash register, so it's harder for the record industry to turn that engagement into a business model. I ask Nancy how the economics works out.
Well, what's interesting to me about the way
you've been researching the music industry is that it kind of takes it from a different direction from a lot of the more common music industry research. And I say that because a lot of the other people that I've spoken to are researching it more from a business model perspective, and trying to figure out how they can, you know, keep the record companies in business and that sort of thing. And there's a lot of law and copyright issues involved in that and intellectual property. But you're taking it more from a sort of fan and community-based approach.
Yeah, I mean, I start from, like I said, I start from the stance of relationship and community. So what I'm interested in is how are people connecting to each other around music, and how are musicians connecting to audiences through music and through the internet. And I, what the way that I see my work is fitting into what you're talking about is that these IP and business model issues need to be contextualized in this broader context of what music means to people and how music fits into people's social lives and how people build connections with one another around music. And that much broader social cultural context, which preceded the music industry by tens of thousands of years and will survive it by tens of thousands of years, is an incredibly important context in which to understand these questions of business models and intellectual property. And that I think the contemporary music industry is often very narrowly focused on the present and on the contemporary scene as sort of the way it has always been and the way it will always be. And I think that they, in all good conscience, believe that they're speaking for music and sort of forget that people were connecting around music long before anybody ever thought to connect it to money in any way, long before anybody ever had the thought of intellectual property. People were singing for each other and were singing together, and people still do without those thoughts. And I believe that people always will make music for one another and connect around music. And I think if you look at the history of music, the music industry is a very temporary little blip on the scene. And I don't think it will last forever, just as the chariot industry didn't last forever.
The reason, or one of the reasons, that the music industry has existed is that they saw there's a demand for this kind of product, and there was a high overhead to not only do you have to make sure that the musician can make a living, you also have to make sure that they can be enabled to do all the producing and touring. It sometimes gets very expensive.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of it. But another reason that the industry exists is that the technology became available to create mass production. And you can argue that the music industry was never built on selling music. It was built on selling vinyl, on which music happened to be encoded. And so now we have new technologies that enable other kinds of things. So I think that the industry did emerge for those things. But, you know, I mean, people toured before there was vinyl. P.T. Barnum brought Jenny Lind over, the first Swedish rock star, and had her tour the world. And there were ways to finance that through publicity and building up excitement and selling tickets and so on. So, yeah, that's true. But again, I think that a demand was created in part because a technology became available that made it possible to have that kind of demand for everybody wanting to hear that particular record.
I'm interested in that kind of business model framework because I was listening to an interview that was on The Sound of Young America that Jesse Thorne does. He was interviewing the band Devo, and they just put out
their
first...
I'm so into what Devo are doing right now. It's so interesting.
That's interesting, because one of the things they said was that, you know, on the show was, you know, the business model has kind of collapsed. And, you know, Devo is one of those bands that was constantly experimenting with how they reach their audience and how they build a fan base.
Yeah. I saw Devo give a panel called Devo, the Internet, and You at South by Southwest this year, which was the best panel I've ever seen in my life under any context. It was my cheeks literally hurt for hours afterwards because I laughed so hard. What I really love about what Devo is doing right now is that they're simultaneously experimenting with participatory production, with transmedia, with doing all kinds of things that nobody's ever done before, and doing things that people have been doing for a long time, like focus group testing. Mm-hmm. So they're doing all these things, but at the same time, they're completely satirizing all of it. So it's simultaneously engaging in those practices and critiquing those practices. So, for example, they did the Devo color test, which there was a little Facebook plugin you could do, or you could go to their website and take the Devo color test. And it would show you a slide like of a line drawing, like the kind you would see in the 50s of a man blowing his nose. And it would say, which color will make this man well again? Red, green, blue, yellow. And so they collected the data from all of this, and they decided that their Devo hats should be blue instead of red because people liked blue better. So there's all kinds of just hilarious, hilarious stuff that's, I mean, from a methodological perspective, and they know this, is just absurd. It's total silliness. It has nothing to do with anything that actually matters. But at the same time, they're also letting fans choose the album title and letting fans choose the sequencing of songs and which songs are on there. But they're making fun of themselves for doing it the whole time.
Right. And they're playing with an idea of how music gets produced. And I'm not sure if this is the way music is getting produced anymore. I mean, is Lady Gaga doing, you know, is her label doing the same kind of like, testing on whether she wears a dress that looks like bubbles? Is that going to,
right,
like,
what happens if fire shoots out of her breast? I don't know. I mean, I was looking through a slideshow of her outfits the other night, and she's so brilliant as a performative fashion figure, you know, quite apart from whatever she sounds like, that whether you like the way she looks or not, you just can't deny that she's doing an incredible performance of clothing. They'll be doing museum exhibits on Lady Gaga's wardrobe one day, and rightfully so.
Well, and it goes much, much further than just music as an art form.
Absolutely. It's a performance. It's total performance the way.
And you're performing your music, you're showing your talent through your music, but you're also doing a great number of things around that may almost have more to do with you becoming a successful musician than your music itself.
I mean, I don't think that it's necessarily any different from what's been going on since the beginnings of rock and roll. I mean, think about Elvis's film career, right? Viva Las Vegas. They were selling Elvis as a cross-platform product. Think of the Beatles doing all the different kinds of things that the Beatles did, the Magical Mystery Tour and Help and Hard Day's Night. I think that it's not a new thing in music to say we're selling more than the sound. We're selling an image and a transmedia product that has a lot of different faces on a lot of different platforms. Posters, T-shirts. I mean, there's always been a whole diversity of what was being sold. The more people have bought the Ramones T-shirt than ever bought a Ramones album. I'm sure people are wearing that who don't even know that it actually has a reference to a real band. So I don't know that it necessarily does affect up-and-coming musicians now in ways that it didn't before.
They'll be constantly having to face the necessity of innovation and disruption in order to become successful.
Yeah, I think so. I think that what's different now is that there are so many more. I don't think there's necessarily a whole lot more paths to actually being number one in the Billboard charts, right? I think that you still need a label behind you. You still need that machinery of industry to distribute you and to make sure that you're in the press and all of that. But I think what's different now is that there are so many different ways you can do it. And if your goal is not to become incredibly rich, but your goal is to make a living, I think there's a much more diverse set of business models available to you than there ever have been before. And I think there's a lot of business models that nobody's thought of yet, but they will continue to think of in the years to come.
You're listening to Radio. Today we're speaking with Nancy Baim, a researcher who studies how music fans engage on the web. The always-on nature of the net can create a lot of pressure for a musician. How are they expected to engage with an audience who is always awake, always a click away, and always wants more? When does the concert end and real life begin?
What I think is one of the biggest challenges that musicians face now is that they're expected to socialize, they're expected to connect with their audience, and they're expected to be technologically fluent and able to create a website and able to get on Facebook and able to put out MP3s and able to do all these technological things, and then able to also do the online socializing. And I think being good at socializing online and being good at making music are completely different skill sets, right? And I think it's, in some sense, I think it's kind of unfair of us to expect musicians to suddenly be good at talking to us. Like, mm-hmm. if you think about going to concerts where they play brilliantly, but they don't talk to the audience in between songs. Like, I saw Dylan a few years ago. Fantastic show. He didn't say a word, not even hello, not even thank you. Not a word, right? Would that fly now if Dylan were just coming out and he said, I don't want to talk to the audience. I don't want them to know about me. I don't want to have any communication with them. It'd be a lot harder. It'd be a lot harder to make it as somebody who doesn't want to communicate with the audience now.
I was just trying to picture Bob Dylan tweeting or Leonard Cohen for that matter.
Like, yeah, somebody right. Feeling gloomy. It's raining.
Well, that's one of the things you highlight, that it's the relationships are so much more intimate now that a fan has
at least the sense of intimacy.
Their group. It's a sense of intimacy. Describe that. Like, what? Why is it a sense of intimacy versus, I mean, maybe something, you know, genuine? Is it, or is there?
I don't mean to say it's not genuine, but I mean to say is that I think from an audience point of view, there is a feeling of, I know this person, I can access this person. If I speak to this person will likely respond to me. If I comment on their blog, they may comment. So there is a sense of knowing this person. That said, it's not like you can show up at their house and they're going to invite you in, right? The artists still have boundaries, and with good reason. They need those boundaries. So at the same time, I do think that from an artist's perspective, the kinds of personal validation and sense of being understood in what they're doing and appreciated for who they are is larger. One of my favorite quotes, and if any of your listeners can find this interview, I've been searching for it and I can't track it down anymore, and I'm kicking myself all the time for not having saved it at the time. It was an interview with Pete Townsend about blogging. And he said that it used to be that when he played a concert with The Who at a, you know, 20,000 seat stadium, he looked out and he just saw an anonymous sea of people. And that after he started blogging and people would comment on his blog posts and he'd comment back, that now when he plays a concert, he looks out and he sees a sea of individuals and he thinks, these might be the people who were commenting on my blog, right? So there's a sense of, I know these people and they know me and we're connected at an individual level. But of course, are those the people who were commenting on his blog? Maybe, maybe not. And if they showed up at his house and said, hey, I commented on your blog, you want to have a cup of tea? He'd probably say, no, get out of here, you're creeping me out. So that's what I mean by sense of intimacy, that people on both sides of this experience a sense of closeness and connection. And it is real and it is valid, but it's not the same kind of intimacy that we have with people that we really know and love.
Now the tools have changed. And you're all, but you're also suggesting that the actual level of intimacy has changed, the actual way that a fan and an artist can engage, the relationship is different. I mean, are there examples that you have come across as kind of like touchstones of this? An artist who's successfully kind of navigated these waters.
Well, I mean, one person who comes to mind who I mentioned in my talk today is Roseanne Cash, who, you know, I mean, she's aristocracy. She's an amazing person, and she's been making music for a very, very long time. And of course, she was raised in an incredibly musical family. And you look at her on Twitter, and she's really connecting with her audience, and she's doing it not as a self-promotional venue at all. She's doing it as a, she clearly really enjoys just being able to share the little bits of her day and being able to joke around with people. And she replies to them. She doesn't follow a whole lot of people, which I think is an interesting example of creating your boundaries, and sticking to them and sort of knowing what works for you in terms of how close you can be to people and how close you can't be. There's a lot of examples of that. I have a friend who was trying to decide what bike to ride and to buy, and Lance Armstrong gave him advice on what bike he ought to buy on Twitter. I commented that Cory Doctorow was becoming my son's role model. And Cory Doctorow replied immediately and said he was honored and to say hello to my son for him. I thought, how great is that, you know, for a kid in junior high to have his favorite author saying he's honored by that and say hello.
In each of these examples, you can sort of see that level of interaction and relationship actually leading to a decision that could influence a purchase. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the way, you know, the industry is, you know, seeing these kinds of practices. Are they seeing dollar signs and trying to spin them around into business models?
Oh, totally. I mean, the buzzword in the industry is monetize. How can we monetize all of this? How do Twitter followers turn into people showing up at a show? How does the number of Facebook fans turn into people buying things? I mean, absolutely.
And is that realistic? Does that turn it into something else you've talked about that perception of selling out?
I think it's a really interesting problem, and I think it's not at all clear. I was speaking with the musician last week who's been making records for quite a while, and she was saying that she can't figure out any kind of systematic sense of how any of that translates. So she was talking about doing a tour with another musician where the other musician has many more Facebook fans. She's got a much more engaged relationship online with her audience. She has a much more active fan community around her. And they toured, and it was a double bill. And they pulled in the same number of audience members, each of them. And I think, you know, the whole question of how you could have 2 million MySpace fans, but nobody comes to your show, is something that's been batted around a lot. So I think that I certainly understand why people want to figure out how to put dollar signs on this, or pound signs, or yen signs, or whatever kind of signs they're using in their country, euros. But at the same time, I don't think that there is an easy formulaic way to translate it. And it's terribly conflated also, because is one causing the other, or the people who are friending you and fanning you, the people who were going to buy your stuff anyhow?
It's easy to look at that and say this is a matter of advertising. And a lot of people in the industry, you know, kind of turn it into that model. And you see, you know, the record labels like RCA and BMG like hiring social media consultants, and they'll take a band and they'll decide, okay, we need to do a 6-stage, you know, audience engagement. And one will be, we do a t-shirt contest. You design a t-shirt for the band. And then, another one will be, you know, like answer, you know, a quiz about your knowledge about the band, and then you get free backstage passes and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
all cool stuff.
It is. It's great stuff, but it feels somehow impersonal. I think a lot of music fans balk at that a little bit.
or the seasoned music fans might balk at that a little bit, because it just seems a little bit less personal when it's not the band and it's their managers or their record label doing it.
Right. And this gets back to what I was talking about in terms of the sense of intimacy, that it's one thing to create. I think Coldplay did a really good example of this with their do a video for our song contest, where one of the things that they did was that they had an, I assume it was really Chris Martin's, I don't even know, right? But it was on the web, but it was handwritten. So it was as though Chris Martin had written a personal note about how amazing and wonderful all the fans are. And I thought the use of handwriting was a really interesting strategic decision for just this reason, that if it's in a font, anybody could have typed it, right? But if it's handwritten, it was really him, right? And was it really him? Who knows? I mean, maybe he signed enough autographs that people could recognize it.
Direct marketing research where they decide, like, if you write, something in handwritten font on an envelope, you're more likely
exactly.
to get a $20 donation.
Right, probably. And it's an interesting problem to sort of create this illusion of connection when it doesn't scale to have that real connection. But I do think that fans are very attuned to authenticity. And if they sense that something is inauthentic, they're very wary of it. They don't want to serve the publicist. They don't want to serve the label. They want to serve the band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's interesting that you talk about this in the terms of scaling, because that seems to be what the ultimate problem with it is. You'll find the bands and the musicians who are happiest doing what they're doing are the ones who, you know, have a reined in vision of what they want to achieve.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's very individual. I think, you know, you encounter really different sets of issues at different levels. What I have seen in spending time with musicians is that one of the things that happens as soon as you start to get kind of famous, especially if you're charismatic, is everybody wants a piece of you. And they come up to you and they don't want to give something back to you. They want to take a piece of you so they can tell people that they met you. Mm-hmm. Right? So they want an autograph, or they want their picture, or they want just a little bit of your psychic energy. I knew a rock star who used the phrase psychic vampires, which I think was really apt, you know, because when you looked at the way that people acted around him, they were very selfish. They were very oriented toward what can I take from him in this wonderful moment where he's right there in front of me, right? And you didn't see a lot of people who approach that interaction with, wow, he's affected me so powerfully. What can I do for him in this moment where we're together?
We've talked to a lot of folks on this show about piracy and the future of the music industry. I wanted to ask you one last question, because one of the inevitable questions is, how can the music industry act as a model for other creative industries?
The model that I would like to see, regardless of whatever kind of creative production it is going on, is a model that views audiences from a perspective of trust and concern for them as human beings, and that seeks to engage them and to validate the kinds of engagement and creative production that they best connect with, and that accepts decentralization, and that lets go of this feeling that they need to control everything that's done around what they do. Whether that's letting people remix songs, letting people download, letting people write fan fiction, letting people do alternative videos, letting people make t-shirts of their thing. I think that all of the creative industries right now are based on a model of centralized power, and that they've